From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature interviews with some of the people behind current hit movies. We'll hear from Andrew Bergman, the director of the new comedy It Could Happen to You. He also wrote and directed The Freshman and Honeymoon in Vegas. And we'll feature an interview with one of the co-stars of It Could Happen to You, Stanley Tucci. He plays Bridget Fonda's estranged husband. Jamie Lee Curtis co-stars with Arnold Schwarzenegger in the new action film True Lies. We'll feature a 1990 interview with her. This week's big release is Clear and Present Danger, a thriller adapted from a Tom Clancy novel. Stephen Schiff has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Eastern time this morning at the request of the UN. Fred Eckhart is a UN spokesman. He says the Bosnian Serbs had no excuse for their theft.
In view of the unambiguous explanations given to the Bosnian Serb leaders by UNPROFOR, today's removal of weapons can only be considered a deliberate act undertaken by the Bosnian Serbs in full awareness of the consequences. UNPROFOR has accordingly decided, within the authority delegated to the force commander, to take appropriate action to respond to this incident.
There's word that the Serbs have now promised to return the weapons they took. Bosnian peacekeeping commander General Michael Rose says more airstrikes are possible if the Bosnian Serbs don't keep their word. All was quiet today at the Pensacola, Florida abortion clinic 1 week after the clinic's doctor and his escort were murdered. But demonstrations resumed at another nearby facility. John Thielen of member station WUWF reports.
Anti-abortion forces demonstrated peacefully outside the Women's Medical Services Clinic where Dr. David Gunn was shot to death early last year. As the protesters read scripture and prayed, escorts accompanied women to and from the clinic some 2 miles from the Ladies' Center, the site of last week's killings of Dr. John Britton and escort James Barrett. Abortions have not resumed there since the shootings. At today's demonstration scene, a few police were visible, although many more uniformed and plainclothes officers stood by within a couple of blocks. All participants appeared to be heeding a plea for calm made earlier this week from local religious leaders. For National Public Radio, I'm John Thielen in Pensacola.
Russian aviation authorities say all 47 people aboard a transport plane died today when it crashed in eastern Siberia. It was trying to land in heavy fog and rain. A Russian Air Force spokesman says the plane just missed the runway. It went down about 5,000 yards short of the landing strip. Other officials say one or more of the engines burst into flames before the crash. Heavy rain is still interfering with investigation efforts. The government says the unemployment rate rose 0.1% in July to 6.1%. The Labor Department says job growth was slightly more subdued last month than it was in June, but it was still healthy. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 19.5 points at 3,746. The NASDAQ Composite Index has fallen almost 2 points to 718. This is NPR. Researchers say a new gene and drug technique could offer promise in preventing reblockage of arteries in some heart patients. Scientists at the University of Michigan say they found that following balloon angioplasty, a patient can sometimes keep blood vessels open by getting an altered gene combined with an antiviral drug. The researchers say this works because it stops blood vessels from making way too many cells to repair damage caused by the operation. That process itself creates new vessel blockages about 40% of the time. The research is described in the latest issue of Science magazine. Lawyers for Congressman Dan Rostenkowski have asked a federal judge to dismiss the 17-count indictment against the Illinois Democrat. Peter Kenyon has this report.
Rostenkowski's lawyers argued in court papers filed with District Court Judge Norma Holloway Johnson that it's unconstitutional for the government to try and prosecute a member of Congress for alleged violations of internal House of Representatives rules. They say that violates the separation of powers provision. On May 31st, U.S. Attorney Eric Holder announced that Rostenkowski would face charges that he converted more than $600,000 in government funds to his personal use over a 20-year period. The indictment alleges that the congressman put ghost employees who did no congressional work on the federal payroll, received cash for stamps at the House post office, and used public funds for cars and other items. The U.S. Attorney's Office declined to comment on the motion for dismissal. Judge Johnson has given the government until September 2nd to reply. I'm Peter Kenyon in Washington.
Again, our top story. NATO says it has carried out airstrikes on Bosnian Serb targets near Sarajevo today. It did so at the request of the United Nations. The attack was triggered by the Serbian theft of heavy weapons overnight from a UN weapons depot and a Serbian attack on a UN helicopter that had taken off to track the direction of the Serbs. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition of the show, we have interviews with some of the people behind current hit films. Andrew Bergman directed the comedy It Could Happen to You. He also wrote and directed Honeymoon in Vegas, which starred Nicolas Cage, Sarah Jessica Parker, and a lot of Elvis impersonators, and The Freshman, in which Marlon Brando did a comic turn on his Mafia Don role from The Godfather. Bergman's screenplays include Fletch, The In-Laws, and Soap Dish. He co-wrote the screenplay for Blazing Saddles with Mel Brooks. Before we meet Bergman, let's hear a scene from It Could Happen to You. Nicolas Cage plays a cop who gets a bite at a diner where he's served by a waitress played by Bridget Fonda. Instead of a tip, he gives her half a lottery ticket. When it turns out to be a winning ticket, he returns to the diner to let the waitress know.
Next time, right?
Oh, actually, we were pretty lucky.
Oh, really? Did you win something?
We won something.
All right. What, we won something? What did we win?
$4 million.
Why are you doing this?
What?
This sick joke.
No, it's not a joke.
This is not a joke.
No.
No. What you're telling me, what you're saying to me, that you're really...
What, you think I'd make this up?
Yes, yes, I do.
I'm not. We won.
The lottery. The New York State, the lottery. The actual lottery, New York State lottery, $4 million.
Yes, $4 million is our share. Happened last night. Well, it would have been more, except a bowling team from Albany called in. They took about $9 million out of the pot, but we won.
And you're telling me that you're actually going to split it with me?
Promise is a promise.
I spoke with Andrew Bergman in 1992 when his film Honeymoon in Vegas came out. That was the first time he directed Nicolas Cage. Bergman told me he loved writing for Cage because Cage had such surprising line readings.
Nick can just go off on a dime, which is what I love about him. You know, and in the movie, he is so harried that it never seems completely inappropriate. He did a line reading on when he visits this Hawaiian chief, played by Peter Boyle in the movie, in which Pat Morita is this cab driver who is taking him there for the purpose of diverting him. And he lives in this rundown, ramshackle place. And Nick doesn't want to set foot in the place. And Pat Morita says, you really should be respectful to him. He's a man of great influence on this island. And Nick did this reading. He said, influence? He lives in a shack! And he exploded on the word shack. And when he did it, the first take was ruined because the producer who was sitting listening to earphones just broke out laughing. It was so funny. So he has a wonderful way of just exploding, literally exploding on a particular word.
Well, it must be fun for you as the writer to hear somebody like bring the words to life in such a surprising way.
Nick does it as well as anybody I have ever worked with. In fact, I think not since Peter Falk in The In-Laws did I ever work with an actor who just absolutely had ingested the rhythms of what I had written and just did it. You know, it's like kind of music to my ears. He really nailed everything. Also, Nick has fabulous diction. I mean, you understand every word he says, which is, you know, not the common thing in movies nowadays. You know, when you're straining to hear what actors are saying half the time, Nick really knocks him out.
I want to ask you about The Freshman, your film from a couple of years ago, where Matthew Broderick plays a young man from Vermont who's going to New York to study in film school. And within a minute of arriving in New York, all of his possessions are ripped off in a scam. And then he's soon involved in what he figures is the mafia, which is headed by Marlon Brando, looking suspiciously like Don Corleone. There's a great film, there's a great scene, a couple of scenes with his film teacher, and faculty advisor who's incredibly pretentious.
Right.
And the first time we see this film teacher, it's in his office, and Matthew Broderick has come in to explain he doesn't have any money to buy books. And the teacher's listening to Shuffle Off to Buffalo, which has the line, "And the wheels go slow, soon we're going to shuffle off to Buffalo." And he explains that he's writing a paper called "And the Wheels Go Slow, Film and Function in 42nd Street."
Right.
I thought that was a wonderfully funny line. And then, of course, I found out that you did your dissertation on Depression-era movies, and that's called "We're in the Money." Was this a little joke on yourself?
Fleabre is there but for the grace of God. I mean, I would have been Professor Fleabre. In fact, one of the props in that scene was he had my book on his desk, "We're in the Money," which I wrote 20 years ago, and which, amazingly enough, is still in print. So it was really sort of a joke on myself. I mean, Fleabre was sort of one of my own worst visions of what I probably would have turned into if I'd continued in the path that I had chosen.
Well, there's another wonderful scene where, you know, the professor, you know, Fleabre is showing Godfather 2
right.
to the class, and he's, like, lip-syncing with all the parts on the side of the room.
Senator, you can have my answer now if you like. My offer is this: nothing. Not even the fee for the gaming license, which I would appreciate if you would put up personally.
Senator, my offer is this: nothing. In that one moment, Michael Corleone says that all corruption is equal, that there is no separation between politics and gangsterism. Now, in the Fleabre treatise, Guns and Provolone, what point is made about the similarities between Karl Marx's Das Kapital, Immanuel Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, and the Lake Tahoe scene from Godfather 2, Mr. Kellogg?
Sir.
You haven't read the Fleabre piece?
Well, I'm in an evolving society.
You need tutorial help from Mr. Bushek?
No, sir.
Mr. Glassman.
In an evolving society, violence and narcissism replace rational...
Shut up!
I hate this guy.
Did you have teachers like this when you were in film school?
Everybody. I was never in film school.
You were never in film school?
No, never in film school. Okay. But everybody's had teachers like this. If it's not in film, it's in something else. Overbearing guys who you instantly know in your gut are full of it, but you still, even after the first class, know you're going to have to spend 14 weeks in purgatory with these people. So Fleabre, I really had fun with Fleabre. And poor Benedict, who played him, was just unbelievably funny, I thought. I just loved him.
Now, your major at the University of Wisconsin was American Intellectual History. What exactly were you planning to do with that?
Well, what does anybody plan to do with American Intellectual History? I guess be an American intellectual, you know, and look good in tweed suits and get tasseled loafers, you know, bass regions, and think thoughts. What I liked about American Intellectual History was the research and going into primary documents and digging through things. And actually, the book on movies was fascinating to do, because I was sort of rummaging around all kinds of stuff. You know, it's like rummaging around the attic of the 1930s. And making connections with all kinds of things in literature and popular literature. So it was interesting work. I thought when I was in college, I thought I'd get a degree and then I'd wind up advising a president, you know. I went to college in the 60s and I thought, boy, I'd like to be Ted Sorensen when I grow up, you know, sit there next to Kennedy and tell him how to be a genius. I thought that's what I would do.
So how did you go from writing about movies to writing movies?
Well, the first good thing that happened to me was I couldn't get a teaching job. That was my first break. So I went to work for United Artists for a year as a PR guy, and I met a lot of really fascinating people, because at that time United Artists was releasing something like 35 movies a year. And I met Fellini, I met Truffaut, all these people I was spending time with. And it was a great education. I made a lot of contacts. And during that time, I wrote the story that became Blazing Saddles. It's an idea I'd had for years of a black sheriff in the Old West. And I sold it to Warner Brothers, and I never worked an honest day in my life again.
So do you know what you're going to be doing next?
There are a couple of things I'm considering. One is a very old idea, and one is something I'm just working on. I would love to do something political. We were talking about advising presidents before.
Yeah.
I think we're ripe for a really good, dark political comedy. There hasn't been a good one since Strangelove, in my humble opinion. And I would love to do one.
Is that hard to do in Hollywood?
I don't. I'm coming off a hit. So when you,
right,
you know, if you have a hit picture, then you have the luxury of saying, "I'd like to do a movie called The Lawn next." And they say, "That sounds interesting. The Lawn. It could be good. Is this like a big lawn or just like a backyard thing?" So I don't know. So that's the, you know, the luxury of having a movie that's number one is that they're quicker to say yes to something.
Well, Andrew Bergman didn't direct The Lawn. His new film is the hit comedy It Could Happen to You. Our interview was recorded in 1992. This is Fresh Air. Stanley Tucci made a name for himself playing gangsters, but lately he's been playing unsavory people in comedies. He co-stars in the comedy It Could Happen to You as Bridget Fonda's estranged and greedy husband, who shows up again the moment he hears she's won the lottery. Tucci has also co-starred in Undercover Blues, The Pelican Brief, Prelude to a Kiss, Beethoven, Billy Bathgate, and The Public Eye. Like many of Tucci's fans, I first saw him in Wise Guy, the TV crime series from the late 80s. He starred with Jerry Lewis and Ron Silver in a series of episodes set in New York's garment industry. Tucci played Ricky Penzola, the head of organized crime which controls the garment industry. He extorts money from Jerry Lewis, who owns a business. In this scene, Tucci is raising his fee.
Okay, this is the deal. Money at 2 points above prime. Consulting fee of 1% a month on a full loan while money is outstanding. All checks to all vendors will be drawn directly from this office, for which there is a one-point monthly service fee. And your contract with Amici Trucking will be updated to reflect contemporary charging practices. 4 cents a unit.
That's more than double what we're paying Amici now.
I know, yeah.
I had an agreement with your father.
Going back 40 years, I know. My father, God bless him, he had a heart of gold. But as a businessman, I mean no disrespect, he was an idiot. So. Maybe you should shop the deal before you decide.
Who's got time for shopping? You got a deal.
Now, this is where I first really noticed you in Wise Guy. I thought mm-hmm. you were terrific in it.
Oh, thanks.
And I was thinking about how much fun it must have been to bully Jerry Lewis on camera.
I was terrified. I really was, you know.
He's a huge personality, uh-huh. Jerry Lewis. Uh-huh. I mean, I don't mean in the scheme of things. I mean, he himself, when he walks into a room, he's a huge personality. I mean, and very funny. One of the funniest people I've ever met. He's truly funny. And I was very intimidated, you know. I mean, Jerry Lewis knows more about film than, my God, just about anybody I've ever met.
Would he do comic shtick off camera?
Oh, forget it, yeah. I mean, it was hard to sort of get back into things. He was always bumping into walls and pretending he was walking into doors and stuff.
So what was the impact of that role in Wise Guy on your career?
I think it had a tremendous impact. And it was funny because I really didn't want to do it. But I was, you know, it was very difficult for me to get work. I wasn't really getting any film work. I was getting small roles in film. And the TV stuff that was coming was always the heavy, and I thought, oh, I don't want to do this heavy thing. It turned out to be a very good experience, and it turned out to have a tremendous impact. The power of television is extraordinary. So many millions of people see it, and...
Well, that was particularly good TV. It was you, Ron Silver, Jerry Lewis. I mean, it was really wonderful.
It was good. Yeah, it was the cream of the crop, I think, you know, as far as writing and everything goes. But it still, to this day, when I walk into casting, a set, you know, a casting sessions or something, people always say, oh, that wise guy thing, I thought you were so great and I saw that and blah, blah, blah. So really it had, it did tremendous things for my career. It really helped a great deal, I think. But at the same time, you know, people then they see you and they want you to do that gangster thing too, that you did so well on Wise Guy.
Now, how do you think you started getting heavy type roles? I mean, if I just sort of still photograph of you, I don't think I'd say, oh yeah, perfect gangster.
I don't know the answer to that question. I suppose because I did it well, and I think it has to do with something called with status, I think, which is a technique that Keith, a teacher by the name of Keith Johnstone, teaches, which is high and low status. The character of Muerte, let's say, in Undercover Blues, is a low status character when he's terrified, but when he is mugging somebody, he comes off as very high status, you know. And in doing somebody like Rick Pinzolo or one of those, or the thing I did in Billy Bathgate playing Lucky Luciano, mm-hmm. they're very high status characters. They control everything just by walking into a room. And I was trained in to be able to do that, to switch your status, which I think is important for an actor. You'll see people who will play always the high status character, the heavy guy, you know, who is always in control. And they'll have that career always, and that's what the guy always does. I have no interest in doing that. I want always to switch things around so that the next time you see me, maybe I'm some guy who can barely, you know, get out of bed in the morning, you know, and has difficulty, you know, making a cup of coffee. He's so low status. So it was really the training that I had that that allowed me to sort of, you know, perfect that technique.
It's a really interesting approach. Could you describe at all how you change your status when you're
I think status changes is really very simple stuff, and then it's a matter of, I mean, the hard work comes in where you must integrate it fully into your being, you know. I mean, it has to take over subconsciously. And, you know, some of the first rules are a high-status person talks more slowly. He moves more slowly. His movements are minimal. He's has a great sort of sense of peripheral vision, something like that. And that's the kind of stuff that I did, you know, in the wise guy thing.
Mm-hmm.
I could shift into that. And then as soon as we'd cut, I would become a low status person, which I am for the most part in real life, which is I talk sort of quickly. I move my hands a lot. I avert my eyes from people and don't look them in the eye a lot of times. Things like that. That's a sort of low status character. Those are a low status character is something like a clown or somebody like that, or Inspector Clouseau mm-hmm. is the perfect example of a low status character trying to be a high status character.
Right.
You know,
right.
And he fails constantly, and that's why he's so funny, because he thinks himself this high status character. The guy says he's a disaster, you know, because he's so low status. He can never do anything as smoothly and slowly as he'd like to. You know, and that's the kind of thing that I worked with in Undercover Blues, too.
Now, you describe yourself in real life as more low status than high status, but can you control that at all? Like, when you know that you're required to have a certain amount of self-confidence, like, say, in an audition when people want to think that, hey, you're really good or mm-hmm. something, can you fake being high status even
absolutely.
If you're feeling low status?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm doing it right now. As we speak. Yes, sure. It's so it never ends, really. I mean, and I think we all do it innately in life, you know. You'll see people do it. They'll see people walk into a room and suddenly they change, you know. And you go, what happened to that person? Why did they suddenly? But they put on this thing and their status changes.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
It's just very interesting, I think. And yes, I can control it, sure.
When you were young, did you have a gift for doing impressions or mimicking people you knew?
Yes, I did. I was a big cheap ham.
who did you do as a kid?
Oh, God, I did. Oh, anybody. I would imitate anyone, and I would come up with things, you know, characters and ways of walking and talking and, you know. I would do anything. I remember my cousin one time. My cousin Dino and I sat on the telephone Christmas Day in my uncle's house, and he would just dial numbers at random, and I would, and he'd say, "Here's my cousin. He's going to do some impressions." And I would do these terrible impressions of famous people. You know, they were just the worst. And people would say, "Well, we wish him Merry Christmas," and hang up. But yes, I was always discovering different personalities.
Yeah, you know, I've heard of phony phone calls and made my share of them, but I've never heard of, like, stand-up comedy phone calls where you call somebody up and you do shtick and then they thank you and hang up.
Yeah, it could be a new thing.
Yeah.
Really annoying thing, but...
So who would you do on the telephone?
Oh, I don't know. You know, Humphrey Bogart or somebody, or John Wayne, or, you know, the classic sort of, you know, people that you imitate. But they were terrible. I mean, they were just terrible. But I believed they were good, you know.
You started acting professionally when you got out of college?
Yes.
And I read that you got an agent as soon as you got out.
Yes, I did. I did.
What were your first stills like? Your first still photographs to show around?
They were awful. They were awful. I mean, I won't mention the photographer's name, but they were just terrible. And I was very uncomfortable, and I still don't like to have my picture taken. Uh-huh. But they were terrible, and I was really embarrassed about them.
What were they supposed to show off about you?
The thing is, I don't know, and I think that was the problem, and I don't think the guy knew either, I think they did me no good at all. I think, actually, when I began to lose my hair, this may sound funny, but I started to get more work, because I looked my age, finally, in a way. Because I'd go in for these, like, young boy roles, and I wasn't a young boy, even though I was young. I mean, I wasn't... you know, I just couldn't do that stuff, you know.
Well, it's true. I've never seen you in the Brat Pack type movies.
No, and I wouldn't be there.
And you're probably the age of some of those people.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know.
You wouldn't have wanted those movies anyways, probably.
Well, I don't know at the time. Maybe I would have. You know, I would have liked anything probably at the time. But, you know, it was a struggle, you know. I don't think people knew where to place me, and I actually still think that they don't know where to place me.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, I want to thank you for having me here.
Stanley Tucci recorded last year. He co-stars in It Could Happen to You. Throughout the movie, I was expecting to hear the song that I assumed the film took its title from. Well, the song never came, so I figured I'd play it for you. This version is sung by the late actor Tony Perkins. And how's this for a bridge into the second half hour of our show? In the film Psycho, Perkins hacked up actress Janet Leigh while she took the most famous shower in film history. Coming up, we'll hear from Leigh's daughter, Jamie Lee Curtis, co-star of True Lies. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And here's Tony Perkins singing It Could Happen to You.
Hide your heart from sight. Lock your dreams at night. It could happen to you. Don't count stars or you might stumble. Someone drops a sigh and down you tumble. Keep an eye on spring. Run when church bells ring. It could happen to you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up on this archive edition, the famous daughter of celebrity parents. We'll feature a 1990 interview with actress Jamie Lee Curtis about growing up the daughter of Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh. She says the public thought of her family as royalty. Curtis stars with Arnold Schwarzenegger in the action film True Lies. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Clear and Present Danger, the new thriller starring Harrison Ford. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A special court has named former Solicitor General Kenneth Starr as the new Whitewater investigator. He'll take over as the independent counsel from Robert Fisk. Starr served as Solicitor General under President George Bush. He's also a former federal appeals court judge. Fisk was appointed by Attorney General Janet Reno after the federal law governing special prosecutors lapsed. Congress later reenacted the law. Reno wanted to keep Fisk, but several congressional Republicans have questioned his independence. Secretary of State Warren Christopher says the NATO attack today on Bosnian Serb targets is a way to keep pressure on them to accept an international peace plan. The Bosnian civil war has lasted for 28 months. NATO warplanes attacked the Serbs, who stole heavy weapons overnight from a United Nations weapons depot. Then they shot at a UN helicopter that had tried to follow them. Christopher called today's action in Bosnia a good step forward.
This is a way to keep additional pressure on the Bosnian Serbs to accept the contact group peace plan. We hope it'll have that effect. As you know, when we were in Geneva, we emphasized the importance of the exclusion zone. I said in the press conference there that we had adequate existing authorities if there were violations, and today's action, I think, shows that we do have strong existing authorities, but we're looking toward an even stricter enforcement over time of the exclusion zones.
Christopher spoke to reporters before leaving on a trip to the Middle East. The Bosnian Serbs apparently now say they will try to return the weapons. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali says Rwandan rebels have indicated they will not insist on taking immediate control of areas now held by French forces in the country. There has been mounting concern that if the rebels entered the French-guarded zone, this would spark another mass migration of refugees into neighboring Zaire. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
The news that the rebels won't enter the French zone right away doesn't end the problems for the UN. Officials must still find enough troops to replace the French forces, who are expected to complete their departure from Rwanda later this month. Meanwhile, Boutros Ghali criticized the slow international response in providing peacekeeping troops, saying it had limited the UN's capacity to reduce the suffering and the massacres, which for the first time he estimates killed as many as 500,000 people. And in a move likely to displease the Clinton administration, Boutros Ghali has suggested that the presence of U.S. troops currently in Rwanda might not be proper. He urges that Washington first seek the authorization of the Security Council. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
Stock prices closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 19 points to end at 3,747.02. Declining issues topped advances by a margin of nearly 2-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The House has approved two wide-ranging banking bills. One of the measures would dismantle interstate banking barriers that date back to the 1920s. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The interstate banking bill is expected to speed up the already rapid pace of bank consolidation in the industry. Advocates say it would make banking more convenient for the millions of Americans who live in metropolitan areas straddling state borders. They also say it would produce a banking system less prone to failure and better able to lend in good times and bad. Those opposed to the legislation say if the bill becomes law, it would mean fewer and bigger banks, layoffs of bank employees, and less control over lending by local bankers. The House also approved a watered-down version of community development lending legislation President Clinton proposed during the 1992 election campaign. It calls for spending $382 million over 4 years to encourage lending in inner cities, poor rural areas, and Indian reservations. Mr. Clinton's original plan envisioned spending nearly $1 billion to create 100 new banks specializing in community development lending. The bill now moves on to the Senate, where it's expected to face a parliamentary challenge from Texas Republican Phil Graham. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Nigerian opposition leader Moshood Abiola has been ordered freed on bail by a Nigerian court, but Abiola has rejected the terms for his release. He's still in police custody. The court gave three terms for his release: that Abiola not address any political rallies, not do anything to undermine the country's peace, and not travel out of the country. Abiola is the undeclared winner of last year's annulled presidential elections. The Justice Department wants a judge to reconsider his order allowing the Citadel Military College to shave Shannon Faulkner's head when she joins the school's cadet corps. Faulkner is supposed to report to the corps beginning on August 15th. However, this new motion could delay her admission. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There was a time when she was known as the Queen of Scream, and after Halloween, Terror Train, and Prom Night, some people wondered if Jamie Lee Curtis would ever break out of horror films. But the comedies, Trading Places and A Fish Called Wanda, took care of that. Then Curtis co-starred with Richard Lewis in the TV sitcom Anything But Love. Now she's co-starring in the big summer action film True Lies. Jamie Lee Curtis grew up surrounded by movie stars. Her mother is Janet Leigh, who starred in Psycho, The Manchurian Candidate, and Touch of Evil. Jamie's father, Tony Curtis, starred in Some Like It Hot, The Sweet Smell of Success, and Spartacus. Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh separated when Jamie was three. She grew up with her mother. We're going to hear a 1990 interview with Jamie Lee Curtis, but first we have a clip from True Lies. Arnold Schwarzenegger plays a spy working against terrorists. But he's kept that a secret from his wife, played by Jamie Lee Curtis. She thinks he's a computer salesman. Here they are getting ready for work in the morning.
I'm late.
Yeah, me too. How'd it go at the convention? Did you make all the other salesmen jealous?
Oh, it was fantastic. You wouldn't believe it. You should have been there.
We were the big hit of the show.
It's fantastic. So I love the computer business.
Listen, the plumber called. He says he has to dig under the slab or something that's going to cost $600.
That's okay.
Well, it's not okay. It's extortion.
So what did you tell him?
I slept with him and he said he'd knock off $100.
That's good thinking. Bye, honey.
You've described your childhood, growing up in the Hollywood area, as growing up with royalty. How would you compare the kind of Hollywood experience with, growing up with your mother, Janet Leigh, who was a Hollywood star? How did that compare to royalty?
First of all, any recollection or point that I make about my childhood, you know, is always made from a retrospective position. It's being made as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
As an adult, I look back on my childhood and imagine that when you have famous parents, particularly Hollywood celebrities who are risen above a status, because they're bigger than life on the movie screen, they were both beautifully, physically beautiful people, very talented, and the public loved them so. There is a royal sense. I remember going to Disneyland and having one of those VIP tours. You know, I never had to stand in a line. It was just that part of my life. It was when I was a child, I didn't remember this. It wasn't like as a child I thought I was a little princess. And as a child, I was a normal kid. I had a great time. And my mother, she wasn't like walking around. I'm saying that the perception of my parents was that they were. My mother raised us in a rural area of Los Angeles, almost a countryfied atmosphere, up a dirt road with a donkey outside our house. In a corral. I mean, we lived in the country. We were raised a very natural existence in California, but certainly not a glitzy, glamo one, which is not something my mother adopted as a personal lifestyle at all.
Did the studios do any publicity around your birth? And if so, I was wondering if you read the articles or saw news clips when you were older.
Well, certainly now, in retrospect, I have many of these funny old Life magazines and photo plays. You know, People have told me all my life, I remember when you were born. And it's not something that I walk around going, a lot of people know when I was born. You know, I mean, it's hard to talk about this because I really want to impart that this is not something that I think about. It's not something that I apply to my life or my daily life ever. It is a fact that this happened. And yes, my parents were huge stars at the time, and my birth was a big deal to a lot of people.
Were there any fantasies that were made up about your family at around the time of your birth? I mean, looking back, can you separate fact from fiction? The Hollywood publicity offices were really famous for just constructing lives that would be glamorous, you know, for making things up about their stars.
I read these things, and I don't believe that one word is attributed directly to my parents.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was made up. I think every single word was made up. Or they would take the fact of that Janet and Tony were married and they had a baby and, you know, our life is blessed by our baby Kelly or, I truly believe that it was just manipulated, which was nobody wanted to know about the sort of downside. You know, now it's very cool and couth. For public figures to sort of come clean with their personal lives. But then I think it was just that sort of manipulation of what people wanted to hear.
What was the downside when
you
were young?
Well, you know, my mother has written in her autobiography, she had been married twice before she met my father. And she was so afraid that someone would uncover this early marriage and make it, you know, a tawdry tale. I'm sure there was unhappiness in my family toward the end of their marriage. I mean, they divorced 10 years divorced 10 years after they were married, but they both remarried immediately. So you can only assume that their marriage was crumbling for many years prior to their divorce. That must have been difficult. I don't know. It's not something I've really ever spoken about. It was not a pretty thing. I'm sure it was very difficult. And if you have any personal problems or any personal traumas that go on in your life, whatever they are, and certainly should not be brought up today. But nowadays, it's very common for people to come to speak of those and to talk about how they affected the person now. Then I think people didn't discuss anything. And I think it led to a lot of alcoholism and, you know, a lot of problems in people in the 50s. I mean, I think I'm talking about a generational thing, not only in Hollywood. I think it was just not the time that you talked about all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it only was personified more in Hollywood.
We're featuring a 1990 interview with Jamie Lee Curtis. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with actress Jamie Lee Curtis. I know when I was growing up, I had so many fantasies that were based on movies that I'd seen. And I'm thinking that when you...
Tell us a few. We want to know.
Never, never.
We here in America want to know.
But I'm thinking when you were growing up,
Tyrone Power and a pair of jodhpurs anything to do with those?
But your parents were in the movies, and unlike my parents, and all of their friends were the movie stars. So I was wondering if the movies, were they a part of your fantasy life, or did they just seem like what the parents do when they go to work?
No, unfortunately, one of my saddest feelings about being raised in Hollywood, if there really is something that I consciously, as an adult, look back on and think I wish I could have changed it. Because I saw and knew movies, the magic is broken for me. And I was never, as a child, like I'm sure so many people who are not from the movie industry, are enamored by films and have a really romantic, powerful relationship with going to movies. Many people talk about, particularly filmmakers and actors, talk about all their lives going to the cinema, all their lives being taken to movies and watching. And I just didn't have that, although I was shown films. they did not impart a magical quality to me. It was more just a very sort of cutthroat, this is the movie, but da, 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 da. And I wish I had that sort of magical dream of being in the movies, that people sit back in that dark theater and think, I'll be up there someday. I didn't have that fantasy.
Since, you know, growing up in Hollywood, movies were so work-related to you, when did you decide you wanted to act yourself?
Well, again, growing up in Hollywood, you know, they were work-related in the sense that my mom and dad did them, and I would go and hang out on the set on occasion. You know, I was in school most of the time, so you don't go hang out very much. And again, I don't have any recollection of when it was I decided to do it. It just was, you know, really by chance that it happened that I'm an actress today, because a tennis teacher I knew was sort of turned into a quasi-manager, and he wanted me to go up for Nancy Drew, which I didn't get, but I guess there was interest in who this girl, new girl, little girl was. I was in college at the time and ended up in California on a month's break and did an independent study on just sort of how to break into show business. And I ended up signing a contract with Universal Studios for right at the end of that month, right before I was supposed to go back to college, and never went back.
This is Universal TV?
Well, at the time it was Universal. Well, I mean, it was MCA Universal. They were the last studio to still have a contract system, very much like my parents. I mean, the ironic thing that, in fact, nobody's brought up very much, and I find interesting, is that both my parents were contract players when they first started acting. They were young people. My mother was discovered, literally discovered. My father was in New York. He was discovered, brought out to Hollywood. Both of them grew up on the studio system. And in fact, I was one of the last actresses in the world to be under contract. Literally 7-year, 6-month option, their option contract, where I got paid $235 a week. And they disbanded the contract system about 3 years into my contract. But I did. They farmed me out to do Halloween. They lent me out. I mean, it was a real contract system. Sharon Gless, mm-hmm. myself, Delta Burke was under contract at some point. Andrew Stevens.
Were you groomed to be a certain kind of actress by Universal? Because you know, in the contract system, you were often groomed to be a certain type for certain types of roles.
No, one of the reasons I think the contract system disbanded was at one point Universal had like a monopoly on primetime television. And so it was very convenient for them to have sort of a crop of young actors that they could still had to audition for parts, but they were paying them a fairly small amount of money and giving them experience. And the hope of the contract system always is that you're going to groom a young star, that one of these times you give this person a part, it becomes huge, you've got this person under contract for no money, and you basically have a very hot commodity which you're not paying a lot of money to and you're making a lot of money on. The problem with the current contract system that finally disbanded was that they never took it that final step. They never had the material or the bravery to sort of give one of these contract actors the big break. They just never had the guts to go with a contract actor. They always went with like some other person from the outside. And so they really disbanded it. Whereas in my parents' generation, you know, they did, and they also, in my parents' generation, there were acting teachers afforded to these contract players. They taught you how to dress and makeup, and they groomed you in as either a, you know, the fresh country girl or the femme fatale or whatever. There was no support given to these contract actors except a paycheck every week and the knowledge that they would get a good shot at getting some episodic television. That was it. So I think another reason it disbanded is it just wasn't, in a modern society, it's just not feasible to have that.
So what did you get? What kind of roles did you get in the 3 years that you had this contract?
Well, I did two lines on Quincy was my first job. Then I did an emergency. Then I played a biker chick on Nancy Drew. Then I did one other show there, and I can't remember what it was. And then I did the pilot for a series at Universal called Operation Petticoat, which during the shooting of the pilot, it was a 2-hour movie of the week. That was a backdoor pilot, is what they call it. And in the middle of shooting that 2-hour movie of the week, we got picked up as a series. So all of a sudden, I was on a series for a year. Operation Petticoat, 1978.
So Universal Studio loaned you out to do Halloween. How did you get the part of Halloween? It was your first movie, wasn't it? Starring role in a movie, anyways.
Oh, certainly. It was an audition. Like, you know, when you're a young actor, you audition every day. And it was just another audition. I just went in and read for John Carpenter and then came back and read again and then came back and read again and got the part.
I know Halloween was considered the first in the slasher films and everything, but really you were the kind of heroine in it who was important because you weren't the passive victim. You were being stalked by the psychotic killer and you were fighting back and you won. And that was kind of a breakthrough in a lot of ways, really. Were you aware of that at the time?
I was aware that I was very glad that I was upholding the strength of women. I was playing the high school brain. I was playing what we all hope are the good virtues of young women, you know, women who are intelligent, who read, who study, who are good friends. I really believed, even though I was being slammed up against the wall by the women's groups, that I was in these what seemed to be exploitation films, I was not being exploited. I was playing the good girls, and I was very happy to have that role.
You're a mother now. Your daughter is two or three?
My daughter's three. Three and a bit.
What are you doing as mother to... I imagine you want to give your daughter as much of a, quote, normal upbringing as possible, because you felt that you were brought up in this, you know, like royal.
No.
that people saw you as royalty.
Yeah, please understand
I really do understand. But it's a feeling I figure you might not want to impose on your daughter.
My husband and I both are fairly private people. My husband being a very private person, and I choose to live a normal life as really normal as I can live. And my big attempt with my daughter, besides just helping her create a real sense of herself, so that if someone does want to know her because she's my daughter particularly, that won't face her, that she will know that she has a very unique and very individual personality, which she does just naturally on her own. She's just a spark of a child. I will never subject her to any of the publicity side of my business. That's a choice that my husband and I have made very consciously. If I'm being photographed in my home, my daughter will not be in the pictures with me. If I'm on Entertainment Tonight, she won't come scampering in the room. You won't see pictures of us on the cover of Good Housekeeping. I'm going to try very hard to keep her separate from that at all costs, so that she can make the choice when she chooses if she wants to do that. If when she is a choice-making young adult and chooses to pose in a picture with me, fine. But I want it to be her choice and not one that I impart on her.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this.
Jamie Lee Curtis recorded in 1990. She stars with Arnold Schwarzenegger in the new action film True Lies. This is Fresh Air. There was a NATO airstrike in Bosnia today. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what will we have on that on All Things Considered?
We'll be hearing today, Terry, about the use of NATO air power against a gun position of the Bosnian Serbs and what was said about it in briefings here in Washington and also in Europe. Also on today's program, Nina Totenberg on the Whitewater hearings that come to a close today. She tells us what in all of the hearings in both the House and the Senate we have learned or might have learned about the Whitewater affair. And also on today's program, a talk with Kurt Mazur, the conductor of the New York Philharmonic, about Dmitri Shostakovich's 13th Symphony, the Baba Yar Symphony, and about the poetry of Yevgeny Yevtushenko.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tom Clancy's best-selling novels have turned out to be big box office at the movies, first with The Hunt for Red October in 1990, and then with Patriot Games in 1992. That movie was directed by the Australian Philip Noyes, who then took a breather and made Sliver, and now returns with the third Tom Clancy movie. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Clear and Present Danger.
It's the third, and it's the best. During the last 2 years, the finest action movies have been structurally very simple. In The Line of Fire, The Fugitive, and Speed took a smart hero and a wily adversary and just let them chase each other for 2 hours. Clear and Present Danger takes a different tack. This movie is so good in part because it's so complicated. In those rare moments when helicopters aren't thundering and bullets aren't flying, you can hear the sound of your brain whirring. The movie begins with the discovery of a murder on the high seas, and the victims are old friends of the President of the United States. They had gotten involved in money laundering for a Colombian drug lord, and when they tried to do a little skimming, the drug lord took his revenge. But here's where things get tricky. The drug lord's right-hand man sees the murders as an opportunity to topple his boss and seize power among the Colombian cartels. And meanwhile, some of the president's men in the CIA see an opportunity too. An Oliver North-style intelligence chief launches his own secret invasion against the cartels with the president's tacit approval. So, from both sides, the American and the Colombian, rogue armies are gathering to fight a very covert and very dangerous war. A war so dangerous, in fact, that it soon claims the life of the head of the FBI. In the middle of all this is our hero, Jack Ryan, played by Harrison Ford. He's working for the CIA's Deputy Director of Intelligence, played by James Earl Jones, but when Jones is diagnosed with terminal cancer, he taps Jack to succeed him. Jack claims he doesn't know enough to do the job, but his old boss disagrees.
I wouldn't know the first thing about doing your job, sir.
You've been around. No big mystery. You've been to the White House.
Once. I hated it.
No, you didn't. Want to know about politics in Washington? Four words. Watch your back, Jack.
The writing in this movie has a lot of macho snap, and that's because it's the work of three old hands. John Milius, who wrote Apocalypse Now, Steve Zalian, who wrote Schindler's List, and Donald Stewart, who wrote Missing. Women get short shrift in this world, and so do all but the most elemental testosterone-driven emotions. Fear, patriotism, courage. But director Philip Noyce has gotten good at keeping a picture going on sheer plot velocity. So much so that he gets away with the sloppiness of the film's final third. The movie shoots right over your objections. I always find Harrison Ford a little unconvincing as a kind of action movie egghead, because he's a reactive performer. And his reactions are always so big and slow. But I think that's also part of his appeal. He doesn't act smart, he just does smart things. And the lack of pretension makes audiences like him. One more thing. In its story about rogue armies operating in South America and lying to Congress under the president's nose, Clear and Present Danger comes awfully close to being an indictment not only of Oliver North, but of the entire Reagan administration. The last thing I expected from a Tom Clancy movie was liberalism.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's archive show was produced by Sue Spolin with Jill Bracey and Barbara Bogave. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker and Audrey Voblaitis. Our researcher Mark Tullis leaves us today. We thank him and wish him good luck with his research and teaching. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The course of a life can be altered in a moment. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with novelist Jane Hamilton about how one moment of inattention leads to the death of a child and changes two families forever in Hamilton's new novel, A Map of the World. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.